So there's a lot to say about Chumash. Let's try to get some of the basic ideas down. That the Gemara tells us, it alludes to it on our daf, and it's more centrally located on daf Nun, that the Gemara tells us that there was a takana of Hamavazves, Al Yavazves, Yosem Chumash, that one should not spend more than a fifth of his money on something. So is that about staka, or is it about mitzvos, or is it about both? So that's where we find a little bit of a discussion. That in our Gemara, sounds like it's talking about staka, but maybe from our Gemara it's more about good advice. There's a lot of back and forth about it. One point to try to remember is that we emphasize what the svara is to say one way or the other, or both. So for example, one could say that it's about staka specifically, and not about mitzvos, because you could say that it's inherently illogical to make you risk poverty for tzedakah. That tzedakah is all about helping poverty, so to put you in a position where you should have to give so much of your money that you're not going to be able to sustain yourself, that inherently is illogical specifically for tzedakah. So one could hear that it's davka there that you have such a rule, but mitzvos in general doesn't have such a rule. You could also say the opposite. You could say that when it comes to mitzvos, so mitzvos are basically between you and God, and for the most part, mitzvos ben adam l'makom, and therefore, a Kadosh Baruch Hu could grant you credit for what you want to do and can't. So in other words, here you'd have to say that spending too much money is essentially either impossible, or Chazal told you it's impossible, that you're essentially an ones then. And in the situation that Avi Nezer expressed it, for example, and that if you're an onus, so Rachmana Patre, so a Kadosh Baruch Hu can say, listen, I know you're trying, and you can't do any better than this, so I'll let you off the hook. But when it comes to tzedakah, if you have people who are literally suffering and who will collapse without your donation, so then it's not going to help that you're an onus. You're going to have to really make sure that you actually help them. So one could theoretically have been machalic in either direction, and there would have been a svar to explain it. Aaron, you have a question? Okay. So this is a question in general, but in any event, it seems like we have this institution by tzedakah, either as a takana or at least as good advice, and the Ramah tells us that it's true by mitzvos as well. That in both cases, this is the rule that one is not supposed to spend more than a fifth of his money because that risks impoverishment. We also discussed the possibility that when it comes to mitzvot, it could be that this idea you're going to have to go around begging, that's a concern of Kavod HaBrios. That's either we'll call it tsar, or maybe we'll identify that with Kavod HaBrios. That we could say that the issue is, this is a statement that you're not obligated to undergo tsar in order to perform at least positive mitzvos. The positive mitzvos is a limit to how far you have to go, and maybe that's beyond the limit. So we mentioned, for example, how Rav Yitzchak Zilberstein had a tshuva about the idea that, let's say, somebody is asked to intervene in a parental debate, and it's too emotionally painful, that maybe we could say that theoretically there's a tsar exemption. It's not just about spending money, it's about other forms of tsar, which maybe one would have to measure by how much money you'd pay to avoid the tsar, but maybe that's really what it's all about. And in that context, you mentioned also how the Avi Nezer has a tshuva about the bris milah, that let's say there's a baby that has a potential lifelong mum, but that mum could be corrected by surgery, but the surgery has to be right away after the baby's born, and it means the bris is going to get pushed off. So can you push off the bris in order to prevent this lifelong issue? And he assumes that yes, that the avoidance of tsar is a justifiable reason to delay a mitzvah saseh. But we also discussed that the Ramah, who's the one who tells us that this applies to mitzvos also, and not just mitzvos, but even mitzvah ogaris. You might have thought that if a mitzvah is not available all the time, that if it's passing, so then maybe we should be more machmir about it. But no, we find that this limitation is there as well. But, it says the Ramah, it's not true about mitzvahs lo saseh, that if you have to violate a prohibition, so then you have to give even kol hon basil. Now, not everyone agreed with this. The Vilna Gaon, and perhaps some of the Rishonim disagreed, that the Gemara in the ninth parak of Brachos, which tells us that you have to love God with all ma'odecha, with all of your resources, which implies you got to give up everything. So some point out that's apparently true about Avodah Zarah specifically. So it seems to be saying by implication that if it's not something on the level of Avodah Zarah, then maybe you don't have to give up all of your resources. I mentioned that Tarek Tzmima has a discussion about a Bagan of Rab, that if one is, you know, let's say, stranded in the desert, so one has to potentially be Machal Shabbos, or otherwise end up losing everything they have. So there, it sounds like you don't have to give up everything you have in order to be Shomer Shabbos. But it could be that, as Rosh Hashanah was noted, that that might be only because in that case it's a pikuach nefesh situation to be left in the middle of the desert really with nothing. Although one could also argue that maybe that's always the point, that maybe the idea of leaving yourself without any resources is always a pikuach nefesh consideration, and maybe that's why one might disagree. But in any event, it's most commonly assumed, like the Ramah, that for mitzvah saseh, you only have to spend 20% and no more. And for Alosa, I say, call home Beso, everything. The exception also seems to be Persume Nisa, that we find that, and now it's in Yom Yoma to talk about the Dalekosos, that when it comes to Persume Nisa, so the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch say by Hanukkah candles, that one has to go begging in order to be able to perform the mitzvah of Hanukkah candles. And the Nagar Mishnah says the source for that is Dalekosos. That the Mishnah says in Tzachim that afilu ani halokeach min atamcha ilo yifchas lo mi Dalekosos, that even if you're taking from Staka, you shouldn't do less than 4 cups of wine. And the Gemara later on explains that that's because of Persume Nisa. So it sounds like you have to ask from Staka to perform mitzvot that are Persume Nisa based. Even though there is some debate about this, and maybe the Mishnah doesn't mean you have to go begging, it's telling us as a community that we should support from stock of funds the mitzvot of Persume Nisa, not necessarily the ones obligated to go asking for it in the first place. There is somewhat of a discussion about this, but assuming that that's the din, that we have to beg for mitzvot of Persume Nisa, so why should that be? What happened to Chomesh? So we saw some possible approaches. One approach is to say, like Rav Shechter quotes from the Rav, that the whole idea of Persume Nisa is we want to advertise the miracle so that we can ask for more miracles. So in that context, it's a little bit incongruous to say that we want HaKadosh Baruch Hu to go outside of his budget, so to speak. He normally runs the world al pi derech hateva, and that we want him to go outside Derech HaTeva, so it's a little bit incongruous to say that in order to make that point, we've allotted exactly 20% and no more, and that we're going to be so precise about it. So if we want him to go above and beyond, we have to go above and beyond. And that was one approach. And we mentioned also the same one of the same tshuvas of the Avinyezer that we mentioned in the past few minutes, that the idea is that onus is the p'tur of not having enough money, and onus only works between you and God. It doesn't work between you and people. And Persume Nisa essentially is like a mitzvah ben avam l'chaveiro, that basically, even though it's a mitzvah you do for God, but it involves you communicating with other people, and therefore it has to actually happen. It's not enough to say that you tried, it has to actually take place. So that, I think we mentioned at the time also, the Paras Yosef, who says that that's also pshat of Moshe Rabbeinu, and I think we talked about this, that Moshe Rabbeinu, why was it that he was so insistent that he should be able to go into Eretz Yisrael if God told him that you can't? So why was he so insistent? So the Gemara says it wasn't because of the Shwarma, it was because he wanted to fulfill the mitzvahs HaTzlius Ba'aretz. So once again, you could say, all right, but Onas Rachmana Patre, that here God himself is saying that it's impossible for you to go into the land, so then why don't we say that he's Pater? So someone suggests, based on the Avnei Nezer, that for Moshe Rabbeinu, all of the mitzvos were like Persume Nisa, that they all involved communicating a message for others, because he was the teacher of Klal Yisrael. He had to make sure that the message got across, and therefore he had to actually perform the mitzvos, and that was why he was so insistent. Okay, so in any event, so we have this distinction, apparently, between mitzvos asei and mitzvos lo saseh. So then there is some discussion, first of all, how do you define one or the other? How do you decide what's considered to be a mitzvah saseh and what's considered to be a mitzvah lo saseh? So is it defined based on categorization, that we say that if it's a positive mitzvah, so then you only have to spend a fifth, and if it's a negative mitzvah, you have to go all out? Or is it based on behavior, that if we're talking about acting passively, so then we have this limitation? If we're talking about doing something active, so then there's no limit. So that could depend on a couple of questions. You know, first of all, why are we making the distinction in the first place? So the distinction might be because mitzvot aseh are generally considered to be a little bit less chomer than mitzvot lo aseh. And how do you decide that? How do you decide that lo aseh is more chomer? So you could say, well, let's look at the onshin, that we generally use an onesh in the Torah as a barometer of how severe something is. So mitzvot aseh, for the most part, have no punishments at all, while mitzvot lo aseh have the varying punishments that they have. So that would seem to suggest that mitzvot lo aseh are more chomer. Now you could say, hi, what about the principle of aseh docha lo aseh? But if we have a clash between the two, so we give priority to mitzvot aseh, doesn't that seem to suggest that they are more chomer? So, not necessarily. Some explain that the whole idea you have there, the Ramban and Chumash explains, that you have a clash between an aseh and a lo aseh. That's a clash between avas Hashem and yiras Hashem. So avas Hashem is a greater accomplishment than yiras Hashem, so we'd rather display avas Hashem than yiras Hashem. But still, it could be that this is not a contradiction to the idea that lo aseh, when they're breached, are a greater transgression. You could say that that's the point, that since it's a greater offense to not do a lo aseh, basically everyone's on that level, that they don't do lo aseh. But to do an aseh, that's even more impressive. So if you have an opportunity to choose between the two, so you'll choose the greater accomplishment, which is performing the mitzvah aseh. So that's one possibility, to say it's all about severity. Or you could say that, no, it's all about behavior, because maybe the idea is that you don't want to explicitly do anything overtly that's contradicting the Torah. But if you're just acting by omission, if you're not doing anything overt, so then we could say that that's not as problematic. So that will affect the whole question. You find this issue asked in at least two other contexts as well. There are at least two other areas in halacha where we make a similar distinction. One is the idea of akiras davrim in HaTorah. The Gemara says in Yevamos that sometimes we are okir davrim in HaTorah. Chazal have sometimes overridden a mitzvah min HaTorah in order to protect other mitzvahs min HaTorah. And if that's the case, so that applies only to positive mitzvahs and not negative mitzvahs. So you find the same question being asked, how do you define that? And also, when it comes to Kavod Abrios, you have the same question, that Kavod Abrios, the Gemara says, is able to override Din Drabanan, and it's able to override Mitzvos B'Shev Al Taseh. So it sounds, again, like the same distinction, and you have the same question. Are we talking about categorization, or are we talking about positive mitzvos versus negative mitzvos? And especially if we want to suggest that when it comes to this idea of spending money, that that's also connected to the idea of Kavod Abrios, then presumably it would play by the same rules. Okay, we noted also that there's other questions. What about mitzvos that are all about spending money, such as a Piron Chov, or what about a mitzvah like Pidgin HaBen? Because it seems like that's not subject to this limitation, because the Gemara asks, let's say you only have 5 shlomim to your name, and you yourself need a pinyan ben because you're a bechor who never had one, and you have a bechor, so what takes priority? Who liftos or no liftos? What's going to come first? So there, the whole question seems to be assuming that you're going to do one or the other. But if that's all the money that you have, why should you do either? So some explain that when the mitzvah itself is about giving money, then you don't have this exemption. It's only about spending money in order to perform a mitzvah. We found also that there's some question in general how to read the Rambam, how to read some of the sources overall, that there's a question about whether this is a limitation or an ideal. It sounds like from the Rambam that it's depends which Rambam you read, but it sounds like it's an ideal. That's the way it sounds like in his commentary to Pirkei Avos, the way it sounds like in Hilchos Matnas Aniyim. that to give a tenth is mita beninus, and to give a fifth is ayinata, to give a fifth, that's what we recommend. So we noted that it's possible that we could see it all as one idea, that maker had been, so one is not obligated to give such a huge amount. It's only when there are people asking for stock, when you have people being toveya, so then you have more of an obligation. That obligation is capped at the point at which you might become impoverished. So 20% becomes the cap, and therefore it becomes both the ideal and the cap. That becomes the number you want to try to help as much as you're able, and if the idea is that beyond the fifth, you become impoverished, so then that's the ideal, and that's also where the limitation is. While the idea of miser, so the notion of miser ksafim we discussed briefly, is a machlokas what it is, it's probably not a din min haTorah. There is a tosfos in Masechet Tainis and Pes, which associates it with a pasuk, but many understand that that's at most an asmachta, a din derabanan, and probably even less than that is probably a minig. And by minig, we don't necessarily even mean a minig like a minig klal Yisrael, but a minig meaning a personal hanhaga, that it is a highly recommended practice, but a practice that is a personal commitment and therefore subject to how you decide to do it. And the notion that it's only for aniyim is going to be affected by that. But if it's based on maaser ani, and it's really a reflection of din min haTorah, so it should really be for aniyim. If it's a minig, and it's a personal minig, so then it's more susceptible to your defining how to do it, and then it could be maybe for other things as well, and that's always a topic of machlokes, especially complicated nowadays, because presumably it only applies if you're able to sustain yourself. So for example, if you're taking sustenance from your parents, then you're probably not chayiv in this hanhaga, and it gets very complicated nowadays also the whole tuition question, because if you have a huge portion of the population that most of their money is already spoken for in terms of tuitions, and you have all kinds of complicated questions of whether that counts for miser, whether a person is chayiv in miser under those circumstances. All of that is very complicated. And we mentioned that the Nodeb Yehuda has a tshuva about miser, where he says that it's awkward for him to discuss it because there's no makaris and shas really telling us what the rules are, so he doesn't really feel comfortable talking about it as a posik. We're going a little bit quickly. Everything clear so far? Any questions on any of this? Any issues? Okay. Well, the Rambam Hilchos Erechin, the Rambam is much stronger about saying that you should not give away more than a fifth of your money, because then you are risking impoverishment, and that's foolish. So we noted that really there are basically three kinds of categories what we could be talking about. When we talk about limitation of fifth, we could be talking about mitzvos, like we said before. We could be talking about stakar l'aniyim. Or a third possibility, like the Rambam and Hilchos Kramin, and Hilchos Erechin Kramin, is we could be talking about donations to the Beis HaMikdash, which is really neither. It's not stakar for the aniyim, nor is it a specific chiyuv. So in that case, we all the more so have an exhortation that we shouldn't go too crazy in how much we give, because it doesn't really fit into either category, neither being a personal obligation nor addressing the needs of the aniyim. We discussed as well that there is a big debate as to what happens after death. So our Gemara and Samach Zayin, our Gemara suggests that this is only relevant when one is alive, because we're worried about impoverishment. But if one is giving away their money at the end of their lives, so then we don't have such a limitation. So the question is, do we have any limitation? So that is a little bit subject to the Girsa, because the Gemara says that Mar Okva gave away a large percentage of his money as he was about to die, and the Gemara says, well, what about Chomesh? And the conclusion is, no, it's okay, because it's the end of his life. So, two questions to ask. One is, how much did he give away? And two, does it matter? Is the Gemara saying that however much he gave away, that is the new limit? It's not a fifth, but it's whatever he gave away? Or is that just what he did? Maybe he had relatives he was worried about. Maybe it doesn't really show us the upper limit. And that maybe the upper limit is beyond that. So there are at least three girsos in the Gemara. Our Gemara has the girsa of half of his money, The Shulta seems to have the Gersa of he gave away a third of his money, and some of the Rishonim seem to have the Gersa that he gave away all of his money, and that becomes relevant to understanding what is a limitation on giving away at the estate. And as we discussed, there are other issues that there's a problem with disinheritance, that the Gemara says that one should not disinherit his children. So that's also subject to a lot of discussion. Is that an absolute prohibition? Is that bad advice? Does it matter how badly your children behave? The Gemara says it doesn't, but the question is there any limit to that? How far do you go? What if they go and join ISIS? Presumably, it's legitimate to disinherit them. Where exactly do you draw this line? So this was a subject of a lot of debate, and we mentioned that there was, 20 years ago, there was a debate about this in the pages of Tradition Magazine, where there was an article that was very against people giving stock at the end of their lives and disinheriting their children. And Rav Schechter issued a response where he disagreed strongly with the article and thought that it's not a problem in the way it was portrayed. The posts can all generally do agree that you have to leave something for your descendants. The question is how much, and that's subject to a lot of back and forth. Okay, anything else that we said about that topic that we should make sure about the Chomesh topic in general that we should make sure to go over? No question, we went through that kind of quickly, and some of that was kind of complicated. No questions, but any of that? Okay, Ari, is there anything that we left out about that topic?
We talked a little bit about the elderly being subject to undue.
Yeah, that's a concern in general. So I think we ended up at that point segueing from there into pressure issues, that's clearly something to worry about. That when we're worried about disinheritance, we should also be worried, especially that if one is putting a pressure on somebody at that stage of life, so then there is a particular vulnerability that could raise all kinds of moral and ethical issues that are also a part of the equation. Okay, so nobody has any questions about any of that stuff? Okay. Yes.
We want to match up the Rambam and Rachim Chachamim with just Karbanos or Hekdesh in general.
That's the context of what he's talking about over there. When in Hilchos Matnas Aniyim, he's talking about Tzedakah, so there he seems to have different standards. So he seems to be encouraging you in general to go for a fifth, and it sounds like you go beyond. And when it comes to Rachim Chachamim, he's much more negative about going anywhere past the fifth. And it sounds like that's probably a distinction between Tzedakah L'Aniyim and money to Hekdesh and things like that.
That would fit into the Avni Nezer's category of being on the Lamakom, if I can forgive.
Yeah, especially because the Avni Nezer would say more than that. He would say that for if you've been on the Lamakom also. But part of the significance of Erech and the Chramim is that they're not even for you've been. So it's a category that fits into neither. We saw reason to be machmer on tzedakah, and a reason to be machmer on mitzvos, but this is really neither. It's not a chiyuv, nor is it for the aniyim. So there, especially, we can understand why the Rambam says this is really not an area where one should go too overboard. Okay, then we discussed some of the exceptions. Also, the Chafetz Chaim and others mentioned that there are exceptions to the Chomesh rule, that, first of all, if somebody is an asher muflog, if somebody is very wealthy, so he could give away much larger percentages of his money and still be richer than everybody else. So then he's not subject to an exemption of Chomesh. He certainly should be encouraged to give more. If somebody, for purposes of Talmud Torah, so that's certainly a position here at Yeshiva University, we encourage you to support Talmud Torah with as much as you can. That's another possible exemption. You also find, the Chafetz Chaim notes, that if somebody is doing it as a kapara, if somebody feels they're really in trouble for a serious onshin in the next world, but the only way they can get a kapara is by giving huge amounts of tzedakah, so then that's essentially, in a spiritual sense, like pikuach nefesh, and that also justifies going above and beyond. So we find certain exceptions to the Chomesh rule, but in general, this is the idea. We also suggested, in keeping with the thesis that we've had throughout this whole daf, that presumably this is all again about the nosing, that the nosing is really encouraged to give as generously as possible, but there is an externally imposed limitation of a chomesh, so that we don't become impoverished. That limitation comes from a v'haflareich perspective, that we don't want you to We don't want you to end up asking for stuff for yourself, so that's not necessarily a halach v'drach consideration, that's a v'halach l'orecha kamocha consideration. And we mentioned the whole chomesh idea as something that really illustrates how these two dinim could go in different directions. That you could say that if you want to be godlike, so other rabbis should give away as much as you can, give away everything. You won't have any physical involvement at all, so that's very godlike. But from a v'halach l'orecha kamocha component, it's not really the way to go because it's not going to be efficient for tzedaka concerns of the world as a whole. And Rav Shimon Shkup, in the aforementioned introduction to Shari Yosher, so he writes that that's the idea when Chazal say, Pasuk in the beginning of Parshas Kedoshim, a couple of weeks away now, Pasuk says, Kedoshim tiyu ki kadosh ani, so you should be holy because God is holy, but the Medrash understands, ki kadosh ani, as a limitation, that Yochel Kamoni, you would think you could be as holy as God. Talmud Lomar Ki Kadosh Ani, we see there's a limitation. Kedushasi Lamala Mi Kedushaschem, God is saying that you can't be as holy as I am. So what does that mean? So Shimon explains that to be Kodesh means to be dedicated to others, means to be selfless, essentially. So God has no human needs, so he can totally give to others. But human beings, they have basic human needs. They can't be like God fully, but they have to hold on to something for themselves. And then they can be pretty Kodesh. They can give away a lot of what's left. So essentially, one could say, if you want to be godlike, so you give away as much as possible. That is true. That would be very godlike, but it won't necessarily address other considerations. And that's where we find this idea of Shema Yitzdarech Lebrios. Some discussion also, so when the Gemara says that it's a takana of Usha, the takana that was done in Usha, so when the Sanhedrin was in Usha, so what exactly does that mean in terms of the default? So what was the din min ha-Torah, the Chasam Sofer, as a tshuva, where it sounds like he means that before takanas Usha, you would have to give away everything, as long as just keep what you have for daily sustenance, but anything extra you have to give away to tzedakah. Rav Vosner thought that was a surprising idea, hard to believe that that's the actual chiyuv. But in any event, practically speaking, that's what we find, that as far as the nosing is concerned, you'd want to give in an uninhibited way, but there is this external limitation that we're concerned of impoverishment. We mentioned also that some understand, we saw some sources, there's actually an isser for one to allow himself to become impoverished. They saw the Yurazov and the Rashi, times like that, but that's also a part of it. And then you could say that the idea of a chomesh is because you have to respect the sister and you have to do what you can to stop yourself from falling into that type of a situation. Okay, is that everything on that topic?
Just about.
Okay, and nobody has any questions on anything. All right, very good.
So we talked a little bit in resolving that round I was talking about before about like a process. A theoretical wanting to give away everything, as halacha v'drachah maybe, but then with the v'ahavta l'orecha kamocha coming to limit, is that, would that be an accurate way to describe
it? Yeah, I think so. You know, essentially, you think that, so what is the chiyuv of tzedakah basically? It comes out that, so meiser, that's a later notion, that's essentially, let's say, a minig. So as far as tzedakah is concerned, so you'd only have to give really a basic amount unless there are aniyim who are asking. So then that creates an infinite amount, except that's not possible either. So then we put this limit of a chomesh to say that you can't risk impoverishment. But as a mitzvah namuchar, you're going to try, or at least as an ideal within the mitzvah, it could be the mitzvah namuchar might mean a little bit more, but at least as a ideal, you're going to try to get as close to that limit as possible. So theoretically, chomesh could be both the limit and the ideal at the same time. Okay, so maybe what we'll do is trying to figure out how best to allot the time. So maybe we'll try to have Hatzalah tomorrow, together with Parsha. And now let's just talk about some of the Purim topics for the next few minutes. We spent some time on that. So hopefully after the midterm for Pesach, we'll talk about most of them so we can complete the circle, talk about the Tzedakah issue related to Pesach. But Purim is a time which we had a lot of synergy potential because Purim fits very well into the whole Tzedakah theme. So we saw, we spent some time on the whole question about Shalach Manos. That we have the mitzvos of Purim, we mentioned the mitzvos of Purim are considered by the poskim, many of the poskim, to be treated as if they are dinim and ha-Torah, even though they are man-made. But they are mentioned in the Pesukim in Megillas Esther, and that gives them the status of Divrei Kabbalah, if they come through transmission. And there is a statement in the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah that Divrei Kabbalah ki Divrei Torah Dami. So that's in a very narrow context, but some of the later Pesukim applied it more broadly and assumed that we treat Divrei Kabbalah like Divrei Torah for all intents and purposes, and we're machmir on all the sfeikos and all the rules. So that being the case, so what's the story? So we have an obligation of Shalach Manos. So what's that obligation about? So we saw that in this particular sugya, there is one chakira which has one extraordinary loyalty from all the discussions of the next two centuries, and that was the Chassam Sofer's structure. The Chassam Sofer was addressing the position of the Ramah, that the Ramah says that if you offer Shalach Manos to somebody and he doesn't need it, so this is the thought that counts, so then you're off the hook, you're in fulfillment of Shalach Manos that way. And others question that, how could that be true? Don't you have to actually give it? Why should it be enough just to offer it to somebody? So there's some Sofer thought that it depends on what the reason is for Shalach Manos. And he did some research and he said that there are two reasons for Shalach Manos. Either there is the position of the Trumas HaDeshen that is there to help for the Sudas Purim, so you send around gifts of food for that purpose, or there is the view of the Manos HaLevi, that it's a way of making friends, because Haman said that we're all dispersed and scattered, and we want to counteract that and contradict that and create unity, and the fastest way to a man's heart is through his stomach, so we send gifts of food. So if that's the case, says the Chassam Sofer, that he thinks the Ramah depends on that, that if it's about making friends, so indeed it's a thought that counts, but if it's about helping with the Suda, so then we would not allow Mechila, because that would undermine the whole system. And that this Chakira became the context for every other issue in Shalach Manos over the next 200 years. If some Sofer himself threw in another question, the question of whether married women are Chayavos in Shalach Manos, that it sounds like from the Ramah that they are, so we thought this was Lushitaso, because if it's about making friends, so then everyone should be chayiv. If it's about the suda, so maybe only the one providing the suda for the family is chayiv. So if the Ramah seems to say that women are chayavos in Shalach Manos without making any distinction between married women and unmarried women, maybe that's the Ramah l'shitaso, that it's all about making friends. We mentioned also that the Chalkas HaSadeh tried to stem this tide and tried to say that it wasn't really a machlokas, that everyone agrees that it's about making friends. It's just that the Trumas HaDeshen said, Davar v'ito matov, that if you're going to give gifts to make friends, you might as well give a gift that's relevant to what people are worried about right now, but not necessarily to suggest it's a whole different idea. But if some Sofer's tshuva was very influential, and this became a popular way of looking at the issue. So we saw how this affects a couple of other questions. What about giving Shalach Manos early? So the Ramah says you can't have the Shalach Manos arrive before Purim. It has to arrive on Purim. And by that he means Purim day, not Purim night, because the mitzvahs are during the daytime. So if it's about the Suda, it would seem like you could get it beforehand. If it's about getting it on the day itself, maybe that's because of what we call the OHN moment, the Oh How Nice moment. When does the person react happily to getting the Shalach Manos, when it actually gets there? And that should happen on Purim itself. I mentioned the Kajik of a Rav, who has a tshuva being Malamed Tzchus, even on those who give Shalach Manos after Purim is technically over at night, because it says if you follow the Trumas HaDeshen that is there to help with the Suda, so if the Suda is continuing into after dark, which it could legitimately do, so then one could be involved in the Purim Suda even after Purim is technically over, and therefore it would be possible for others to help with your Suda during that time. Okay, so far so good. I feel like I'm going fast, but nobody seems to mind, okay? So, I mentioned a couple of other possible ramifications of, and it very much contribute to our synergy of just how much does this really parallel a staka consideration. So, for example, what about giving anonymously? The Ksav Sofer has a truth about this. Again, nowadays, we don't recommend giving unmarked packages outside people's houses, but in a simpler time, so could you fulfill Shalach Manos anonymously? So the Ksav Sofer thought that if it's about making friends, then it's not going to help. They're not going to know who it's from. And if it's about spreading goodwill, it's about helping the Suda, so then it's a Staka consideration, and we find in our Gemara is that Staka is better when it's anonymous. So it's going to depend on what the purpose is. We discussed also the question, also very relevant to our sugya, is we're talking about Kfiya, so could you have Kfiya by Shalach Manas, as was discussed by Rav Zhalti, where he assumes that if it's about a Staka issue, so then we do find that Staka could have a place for Kfiya. But if it's about making friends, you're not going to really impress people too much when you show up with the U.S. Marshals saying that you have to give this gift. In terms of impressing people, we also found that the Ritva writes on Dav Zayin in Sukkah that if you're going to give to a wealthy person, so then if the gift is not big enough to register on his radar screen, or vice versa, if a wealthy person gives you something that's so small it's going to look like it's not sufficient for his capability, so then that might not be too impressive. And if the issue is making friends, then we're more concerned about it being impressive and not by whether or not it's theoretically helpful towards the Suda. We discussed also the question whether you could give Divrei Torah for Shalach Manas, that if it's about the Suda, so there is a discussion that maybe it could be Yotzei Shalach Shudas for Divrei Torah, or Chaim advised against it, because maybe your Divrei Torah will get slugged up, unlike the filter fish, which tends not to get slugged up. But that's probably not the relevant seer to say that it could suffice for food. So it's going to help for your Suda, it's a little bit less likely. But it could be that if it's about making friends, so then maybe this is a good way to make friends. So it's interesting, it comes out that the Manos HaLevi and the Ramah, according to that logic, would be on the pro-Divrei Torah Shalach Manas team. And it seems like they both did that themselves, that they both wrote Svarim about Purim that they gave out as gifts, the Manos HaLevi writing the eponymous Manos HaLevi. And again, the Manos HaLevi was written by Shmuel HaKabetz, who was the author of the Chadodi. And the Ramah wrote a sefer called Mechir Yayin, which he darshaned every word of the Megillah, and he gave that out on Purim as well. And then we talked about the question of why is there no bracha on Shalach Manas. So if one looks to the Rashba says there's no bracha on Staka, apparently because we have to worry that the recipient may decide he doesn't want it and leave you hanging. So according to Ramah, you don't have that risk when it comes to Shalach Manas, the Riyotza either way. So then why should there be no bracha on Shalach Manas? Now it's not necessarily true that you don't have this risk, because the Ramah probably only means that if the person says, thank you so much, it's a thought that counts, then you're Yotzei. But if he throws it back in your face and says, I aggressively have no goodwill for you no matter what, so then maybe it's not going to be effective as a Shalach Manas. But assuming that it's true that you're not contingent on his acceptance, so why should there be no bracha? So we discussed various other answers. So some say, like the Beis Yosef and Helpless Pesach, you don't make a bracha where the kiyum is belayed. So when it comes to Shalach Manas, if it's about goodwill, so then again, maybe the kiyum is belayed. Another approach is Radiation of the Tshuva, that if we're trying to make friends, then to come with a statement of, before I give this to you, I just want to say, thank you, God, for forcing me and ordering me and commanding me and requiring me to give you this gift. It's also not going to go over so well. And then there is also the position of the Das Sofer. The Das Sofer notes that it seems like Shalach Manas, at least according to one possibility, has a lot in common with Matanos Lev Yonin. And maybe that's the whole point, that we have these two mitzvahs, Shalach Manas and Matanos Lev Yonin, and we want Bedavka to blur the distinction between the two. We want it to be that we can provide for people who are very needy through Matanos Lev Yonin, less obviously needy through gifts of food called Shalach Manas, and sometimes both at once, possibly. So we don't want to call attention to one or the other, so therefore we can't have a bracha that's going to identify which mitzvah we're involved in. And we mentioned the Akhi Darach HaDrush, that Rav Nachum Zemba noted that the Gemara says in Megillah that the reason that you don't have, the reason that the Jews were threatened with destruction at the time of Purim was either because they benefited from the Suda of Achashverosh, which was very inappropriate, or because they bowed down to the Avodah Zarah of Haman. So either way, if it's about the bad Suda, so you fix that with a good Suda. So Shalach Manas helps with that by helping with the Suda. And if it's about It's about the idea of Avodah Zarah. So the Medrash says that you can atone for Avodah Zarah through Shalom, and perhaps that's the point.
So the Gemara rejected him, I suppose.
Well, Gemara says that he wasn't actual Avodah Zarah.
For the Suda.
Of the Suda, right. So that's at least theoretically an option. So between the two, you have all your bases covered.
We talked about how the Sama Rebbe fit in.
Yes, so I first had mentioned that I first thought that one issue that does not seem to have any relevance to this Takira is the question of do you need shlichus? That some of the poskim, prominently the Binyan Sion, had a discussion that it was based on Iran, that should we say that when it comes to Shalach Manas, that you should bedavka use a shliach, that you should use an intermediary. And he concludes ultimately that you don't have such a chiyuv. Yeah, parenthetically discussed, it would be strange because normally when it comes to shlichus, so normally we prefer, even when shlichus is possible, we prefer that you don't use a shliach. We say mitzvah bo yosem b'shlucho, and we generally also say that if it's impossible for you to do it, then shlichus doesn't even work. So to have a mitzvah which can only be done through shlichus, that's very unusual, and it's hard to understand how that's a possibility. So the Zvar Ram explains that we're not talking about shlichus in the general halachic shlucho shel adam kamoso sense. We're talking about a more practical concept of an emissary, which is why even those who are machmir for this, they use children, they use non-Jews, they use people who are not necessarily b'toras shlichus, because it's not halachic shlichus, it's just about using a messenger. But either way, it shouldn't depend on this chakira, except the Sadmar Rav thought that maybe it did. We had to paint the picture in somewhat extreme terms. But if you paint extreme examples, so you could see how if you give Shalach Manas directly to somebody, then maybe they just might think they ran into you in the street while you were giving them out to random people and they got one. So it doesn't necessarily feel like it's so heartwarming for them. While if you use an intermediary, so then that shows you have to have planning beforehand in order to find this person's address and to have this intermediary given to them. And therefore, that's going to be more impressive as far as goodwill is concerned. So therefore, he suggests that the idea is that if you want to try to fulfill the goodwill consideration of the Ma'aseh Levi, then maybe there is a greater significance to having it done through an intermediary. Okay, before we transition to Matanos Levionim for a few minutes, was there anything that left out about Shalach Manas?
Yeah, so Sofer talks about whether you can give it anonymously.
Yeah, that we spoke about.
Okay. Whether a katan is included in friendship or something.
Yeah, there is a discussion. Some posts can talk about can you give to a katan, and here they're very careful to uphold the minig that this is Tali and the Manas Alevi and the Chumash Hadeshin, but you find both ways, that there are some who say, well, if it's about making friends, you only really make friends with your own age group. But for the Suda, it helps because the Katan was also part of the family Suda. While others say the opposite, that if it's about the Suda, so then it's no good to give to a Katan because he doesn't have a Chiv in the Suda. But if it's about making friends, you can be friends with everyone, so then that's also going to be significant. Okay?
Yeah, I may have just missed this, but did we say about Shechianu possibly
covering? Shechianu, we talked about a little bit in Matanos Levionim. That so we'll transition with that.
But it also covered for himself.
So let's, well, it does, but the question about it was about Matanos Levionim. So let's transition, let's use that as a transitionary point. So, but you're right, it does cover Shalach Manas, but the question about it was for Matanos Levionim. So Matanos Levionim, which clearly has even greater synergy to our Saka topic, Shalach Manas had a lot, so Matanos Levionim has even more. So what about Matanos Levionim and Saka in general? So the general question that you find is, should we say that Matanos Levionim is a basic chi of staka, like we find throughout the year? It's just intensified when it comes to Purim, and maybe you could say it's intensified simply by the basic fact that people have greater needs, and therefore it's automatically intensified. But either way, you could say it's basically a staka point. Or you could say it's not really about staka. Like the Ritva mentions, like the Rambam sounds also, that it's an expression of simcha. That part of simcha is that you should be involved in giving. That's how you show that you're happy. That's how you make yourself happy. The Rambam sounds in Hilchos Megillah that it's about simcha. Elsewhere in Hilchos Yontif, he says that simchas Yontif is shown to be genuine only if you're willing to have people who are needy at your table. If you say that they're not welcome, then that shows there's not real simchas yantif. So it could be also that that's what Matanos of Yonim is about. That Ritva, parenthetically, is commenting on the Gemara in Bava Metzia, which says, Magnus Purim, the Purim, that which is the collective for Purim, should stay with Purim. So there he emphasizes that it's about Purim specifically because of the simcha that's involved. While Tosfos had a different reading, Tosfos talks about whether you can switch it to something else. And Tosfos says that other stuff is you can switch, but the stuff of Purim has to stay for Purim. And the idea that it's about simcha, so that could affect the question. So to go back to Sammy's question of whether it's really a mitzvah of the day or not. So in terms of what Sammy was saying before, so Shechianu, so we make one Shechianu in the morning. We make two Shechianus total, which is itself a whole discussion. That's more about Mikra Megillah questions. But we make a Shechianu in the morning and Shechianu at night. With the Shechianu in the morning, so the Magen Avraham says it's supposed to cover all the mitzvahs of the day, including Shalach Manos. So some ask, well, why doesn't he also say, including, like the Prichadish says, including also Matanos Lavyonim? So others say, no, he purposely left out Matanos Lavyonim, because Matanos Lavyonim is not a mitzvah of the day, it's just a stuck all year round mitzvah, which is intensified on Purim. And on the other hand, the Prichadish seems to be saying that, no, it's a specific mitzvah of Purim, of how you express simcha, and therefore it should get its own Shechianu, and that's just grouped in with the one that's said over the Megillah. Sammy?
Yeah, so this is, I think, the reason I got confused. Is
it's not confused, but you're right. I mean, what you said was true.
Right, but is it possible that the Shechianu for Mishloach Manos is a reason why we don't say a bracha on Mishloach Manos, because it's covered in the Shechianu?
Well, it would only cover the Shechianu part of the mitzvah. It wouldn't cover the bracha part of the mitzvah. Could all connect to the overall stucca links, but the Shechianu has its own consideration. So this question of whether it's stucca or not could affect a number of other issues. First of all, the question of whether an ani is chayiv or not. So it sounds like from some of the poskim of Bach, for example, that an ani is chayiv in Shalach Manos, and the Prichadish says doesn't make sense. Why should you make somebody take? I'm sorry, Matanos Lavyonim rather. Why should you make somebody take from stock in order to give to stocka? So we could understand that it's not really about stocka, but it's really about simcha, so we should see why an ani is chayiv. And it's also noteworthy that the same Prichadish who says an ani shouldn't be chayiv in Matanos Lavyonim says he is chayiv in Shalach Manos. So it shows that he understands them as different, that Shalach Manos is about one thing and Matanos Lavyonim is about another thing. We also suggested doing a chakira graph, that we could take our general chakira about staka and graft it onto Matanos Lavyonim and ask, what is Matanos Lavyonim about? Is it a din in making sure that people are taken care of in a practical sense? In which case, again, it wouldn't make sense for somebody to take staka so that he could do this. Or should we say that it's a din of the nosein? The nosein expresses his simcha through giving, and therefore even an ani is also obligated in this. And we discussed about what the shear of Shalach Manos is. Some of the Rishonim say a pruta, and the later sources they say a meal. It's kedai to be machmir for that, but if a minimum one should give at least pruta. We talked about also the question also of kviya by Matanos Lavyonim. Same kind of question, is it about simcha or is it about staka? And we mentioned how the Chuvus Tirush V'Yitzar writes, this correlates also to what we said from the Das Sofer about the brachos, that in general we found during the time of Purim that being involved in giving, being involved in this act of generosity was what saved us during that time. So we've upheld that practice that Purim should be a day of giving, but it was done in a broad way, so it has both Matanos Lavyonim and Shalach Manos. And part of what that accomplishes is that there's no embarrassment associated with Matanos Lavyonim, that because everyone is accepting on Purim, so therefore no one is in a disadvantaged position, and therefore you don't have to worry so much about people not knowing that they're getting or who's giving. And so, for example, Yitzchak Zilberstein has this essay, Daf Ganar Daf, just to highlight the synergy, that he thinks that when it comes to Matanos Lavyonim, that maybe there is no requirement or no advantage that a daf could be not in front of the person. Maybe it should be in front of the person, so you should be able to be mesameach him more directly. We also, maybe we should mention this first, but perhaps the this is a point that the Rishonim mentioned, that one of the biggest indications that it's not a straight stucca idea is that, as we see also from our daf, that stucca requires a certain degree of responsibility, that we should be careful to make sure that we're giving to deserving people. But when it comes to Matanas Levionim, so we have this din of Ein Bodkim, and the Rishonim explain that we're just giving Shum Simcha, and therefore that means both positive and negative things. It means that we give very liberally without really checking necessarily that the person is a good recipient, and also negatively, that if we're going to be very distinguishing, we're going to be very discriminating, and we're not going to give certain people, so then that's going to create animosity, it's going to create Eva, and the whole point is we're trying to create Simcha, so we're especially sensitive to Eva. Okay, were there any other major points about Matanas Levionim we left out? Ari?
Did we discuss Mishloach Manos and Matanas Levionim in one chat?
Right, it's also a related question, essentially, could they be going together? Are they the same mitzvah? Are they two different versions of the same mitzvah? Are they essentially accomplishing two different things? That's also a discussion. Any other topics?
So with the timing and...
The timing, right, also that it should be on Purim itself and not before Purim. Right, the question also of who has to be... I got the Shaila on Purim. The question of, so who are we interested in? Are we interested in the no saying should be given? Let's say if there is some kind of disconnect, clearly it's the most direct if you give to an avion on Purim. But let's say you don't have such immediate access, so you're going to give to someone else and the avion's eventually going to get it. So what are we most interested in? Are we most interested in that the giver give on Purim regardless of when the avion gets it, or that the avion receives on Purim even if the giver gave it before Purim? Which both of those are possibilities that we find in the poskim. Poskim write also that a shliach can work in both directions. Maybe the shliach can give on Purim, the shliach can receive on behalf on Purim. So, for example, the view that you find that you don't have to actually have him receive it on Purim, you can give it to a shliach. That's how many poskim hold. And some add that he has to at least know about it, that if he knows that there's money coming to him and the shliach has it on his behalf, so then you're accomplishing the simcha and the tzedakah, and that will accomplish everything that we're looking for. Okay, any further thoughts about this?
Well, necessarily, meaning more ideally you could give it to him.
Right, but let's say that's not so possible. Right, right, so let's say if you don't have immediate access, right, that's clearly the best. Right? If you're able to just give it to an avion, then that's the best. But let's say you don't have such great access, so what are we most interested in? So presumably, if you give it on Purim to a shliach who accepts it on his behalf on Purim, and the Ani knows that it's coming his way, then that accomplishes many of the things. That's one way to look at it. Okay, so any other points about Matanas Levionim?
We talked about Matanal and Nasahanas.
Right, Post can also discuss that, which is a little bit strange. We're not really able to totally understand that. They talk about two shilas, if they're the same, but we understood one more better than the other. That one is, what if the Ani is Mochel, if he says he doesn't want it, the thought that counts. So then that could parallel Mishloach Manos, that if it's really just about goodwill and Simcha, maybe that's enough, but if it's about Stucca, you might require actually getting there. And they assume that a parallel question is Matana Manas Lahachzer. It's called Matana, technically, but he doesn't actually get to keep it, he's got to give it back to you. So, yes, theoretically, if that's the Kiyum and Simcha, I guess that would follow as a Nafkamina. I don't understand the Metzias exactly where it comes up, but you're actually going to gladden any poor person by giving him a gift of money that he has to return to you. It's not even a loan, it's just he gets to hold on to it and give it back to you. I don't really know how that could possibly accomplish too much, but theoretically, it's discussed in the same breath as the Mechila question. Okay, is that basically covered what we spoke about there? Okay, so what we'll do is, I guess we'll dive in for now. Again, tomorrow we'll try to do Parsha and the Hatzalah topic, and then the spirit of Hatzalah, we'll do triage afterwards to see how much time we have to cover other topics before Monday. All right, Yashikoa. Ashvi, Yashvi, Sacha.